Representative Wheeler, how are you today?
I'm not bad, Neil. Julie, how are the two of you?
Well, we're hanging in there. Are you okay? You sound like you have a cold, perhaps.
I have been fighting a cold all week, and so my voice does sound a little more bass than it should.
Record an album.
There you go. Yeah.
lemonade out of lemons. Do it.
Yeah.
There you go.
Add a little honey to it, and it'll help your throat a little bit. Well, Representative, let's dive in. Legislative session. Here we are. First week of March. Probably 2 or 3 weeks left. Give us your assessment of how it's gone so far this year.
Well, I would say it was a bit slower start than any of my other three sessions, but then once things really got rolling in early February, we've had a lot of legislation in motion, right? I like Neil's optimism that there might only be 2 or 3 weeks left. I do hope that's the case. But well, I think you see some of this ongoing budget conversation is really going to be the thing that decides how long we're here for, more than anything.
One of the, and I can't remember which specific areas of the budget it is, I'm sure you could tell us, but I thought, okay, going into this, you have both Representative Tanner and Senator Groh, who are pretty hard line on budgeting. And I thought, okay, they're going in as a negotiating point, but they'll probably give on a couple of issues. And I believe they have. I've seen some stories where they have relented and agreed to fund a certain part of the budget. It's not widespread, but it is sort of these surgical targeted areas. Do you think we're going to see more of that, that they'll see, well, if we hold fast to this really tight or reduced budget, then it's not going to pass the House, and maybe they will look at easing up just a little bit?
Well, I think you see that. Just earlier this week, the rescission budget, which is the one that, again, the co-chairs have determined, let's have a 1% additional across the board cut, narrowly passed the Senate, like literally by one vote, right? And I think the fact that it did that probably gives them a sense that in the House it will also narrowly pass, but it will still pass. And so I don't know that they will look for very many more surgical adjustments, like you've I like the way you've called that, Neil, but you know, the one that that comes to mind was one dealing with the budgets to county jails, right? The daily reimbursement for prisoners that county jails are holding for the state. And that one, if you'll recall, came to the tune of about $3.1 million. And that was one that I think the co-chairs conceded to only because the body passed a policy bill, you know, with pretty overwhelming support to say, yes, we do need to make that adjustment because, you know, we can't put so many unfunded mandates on our counties and on our county sheriffs, et cetera, that they can't operate. And so I think that if we get more policy bills like that, I know there are some in the works, but I haven't seen any have quite the level of support that particular one did regarding the county jail reimbursement rate.
Representative, do you have an idea of how you plan on voting on that 1% cut that will be headed, that vote will be headed to the House?
Well, honestly, I've tried to be pretty consistent, Julie, about feeling like I want more precision cuts. You know, the budget that I spend the most time looking at myself, which I suppose a lot of people do because it's really the largest chunk of our budget, right, is the Department of Health and Welfare budget, the Medicaid budgets, and that kind of those kind of things. And one of my concerns is that when the governor took his across-the-board cuts last year, Medicaid absorbs those cuts very disproportionately because there are many programs in the Medicaid space that we cannot touch federally. And so it might say 4% across the board, but what it really means is that one corner of the budget doesn't get touched, and the other corner of the budget actually ends up absorbing a 6 or 7% cut, right, in order to equal the 4% across the board cut. So that my concern is that there is some more precision adjustments that could be made where, you know, for example, there are cuts in ResHab that it makes sense to make, and we could make those a little deeper, adjust those rates because they've really become a bit of overutilization, and that would allow us to keep whole some other programs that really are not really cannot adjust very well to across the board cuts that disproportionately hit them. So I'm leaning towards a no on that particular rescission budget, but I that's sort of an ongoing conversation for sure.
One of the, I guess, questions that I have, and I mean, this was warned about years ago, almost 10 years ago, when Medicaid expansion was passed in Idaho,
mm-hmm.
that the costs of Medicaid expansion will balloon, that it is a really, really good deal in those early years, but it became less of a good deal as the years wore on, and we indeed are seeing the it's one of the biggest challenges I think that you have as lawmakers. This is exactly what the concern was early on in implementing this. So as you look at solving this issue, there are even some lawmakers that just want to repeal the Medicaid expansion because it has become quite expensive. But the problem, and some other lawmakers want to take the rainy day fund, the $1.3 billion or however much that we have, and prop it up this year. But I think it was Senator Groh who said, we can't use one-time money for an expense that's ongoing, that we have to figure out a systemic solution that works from year to year rather than raiding a bank account to keep it going. And I'd love for you to comment on that. I know you own a business. You know how important it is that budgets balance and that things get paid and how things should operate ongoing. And so I guess speak to that issue, because I think there's very little appetite to raise taxes in Idaho. Not even the Democrats are proposing that. But,
agreed.
But so how do you do this in a way that's sustainable? Because if you raid the rainy day account this year, but next year we have the same problem, then there's not as much money there. So speak to that.
Yeah, I think that's really the heart of the question, I think, this legislative session, Neil. And, you know, the number that I keep using is $880 million in the budget stabilization funds. The 1.3 is if you also take into account the public education stabilization funds and some of the other accounts, right? But I remain convinced that this is really only a temporary cash flow issue, because we stacked, you know, $450 million of state tax cuts over the past couple of years. And then, unbeknownst at the time that we did those tax cuts, we got to then also introduce the One Big Beautiful Bill federal tax cuts. And so all of that is really what has created this downward budget pressure more than anything. And I remain convinced that we will revenue grow our way out of that temporary bump, which is why I think that a strategic use of some of those budget stabilization funds for one-time expenses can buy us the time that we need to let the economy catch up to you know, these multiple tax cuts that we've made over the past few years. But Senator Groh is right that we cannot use that for ongoing. I think one of the things that gets lost in the conversation about the Medicaid expansion, Neil and Julie, is that we use a portion of the hospital's upper payment limit. We functionally tax our own hospitals to cover the state portion of the Medicaid expansion. And so that portion is really not the piece that I think concerns everybody. It's the size of the federal portion, right? Because it's a 90-10 split. And so one of the solutions I've heard suggested, I haven't seen the bill yet, right, is this idea that, well, we ought to repeal Medicaid, you know, at the end of the year, and then introduce a new Medicaid expansion. Sorry, not repeal Medicaid, repeal Medicaid expansion, and then introduce a new version of the Medicaid expansion on 1/1 of the following year, with, you know, all of the controls, caps, waivers, et cetera, that we believe will let us control those costs long-term in a sustainable fashion. Again, I haven't seen the bill yet. It's one of the more creative suggestions that I've heard. But I think that we really need to just take advantage of the opportunity we have right now with our current federal administration, with some of the people from Idaho who are now working in that federal administration and can really advocate for Idaho's best interests, to either tune that Medicaid expansion program, or if repeal is really the answer, which is I don't think it is yet, because that was such a grassroots effort, right? That there are so many people who believed that that was the way we needed to advance. We need to find just the correct tuning to make it sustainable long term. So I think that's kind of what I see in that portion of the conversation.
Okay, I know we're focusing heavily on the budget, and I do want you to have a chance to talk about your epinephrine bill that I believe is still in the Senate, but we'll get to that in just a second. We've asked several lawmakers about the potential of fraud in Idaho. We're seeing massive fraud in both California and Minnesota. I don't personally believe we have anywhere near close to that, but I think we would be sticking our head in the sand if we didn't believe there was some issues in Idaho. Where do you believe we can find those options to save some money in those different areas? Or maybe it's just really trimming some budgets. I know we say we want to be surgical, but then I don't think anyone is brave enough to say where. So where do you see that we could do that?
I think that's a fair concern, Julie, about not being brave enough to say where. There is legislation coming that would essentially direct the Department of Health and Welfare to run an audit on 15% of the providers in the home and community-based service space every year for the next 5 years. And I think that's the kind of legislation that we need to continue to pursue, because that's going to do exactly what you're saying. I agree with your assessment, Julie. There's no way Idaho is free of fraud, because that's the world we live in. But there's also no way that we are at the levels of corruption that we've seen in some of those other states, right? But if we can spend a little bit of effort and direct the department, or direct, you know, an outside agency that has the proper role to do those sort of audits that haven't been done apparently for at least a decade, as it was explained to me, then I think we can find, not only does that give us an opportunity to find potential fraud, but it also gives us an opportunity to see, are there some efficiencies that we've been missing? And that home and community-based service one is a great example, where as we've looked at it, it appears that it's got four tiers, and right now patients are tending to be assigned to the highest tier just by default, which doesn't necessarily make sense, right? Because then you have to justify moving them down a tier so that they're, they cost less per day. Whereas, you could find through audit, should the default be that they end up in one of the lower tiers and have to be justified moving up. Just a small example, but that's the kind of legislation that I think will help us be more precise.
We're talking with Representative Josh Wheeler. Really quick, because we only have a couple of minutes left here, Representative. But
sure.
The immigration issue, the E-Verify issues, I know that some of that has come through the committee that you sit as the vice chair on, the business committee. And
yeah.
I guess my question to you, I know that you have, if I'm correct, you have opposed both 700 and 704. Which is okay. That's not a criticism. But do you believe that the status quo is okay, that we should let the federal, it should be entirely in the federal government's hands, and the state should largely be agnostic when it comes to illegal immigration? Or you just, we should do more, but you just didn't like what was put forward this year?
Yeah, fair question. And honestly, Neil, I ended up splitting on those bills.
Oh, you did.
So 704, I did support because I felt like it. You're trying to walk a narrow line there, but it was at least fair across the board. It set expectations to say, like, you know, everybody's got to use this system, and you know, here's the penalties if you don't use the system. I actually liked the idea behind 700, where, you know, we're basically trying to just communicate that here's Idaho's, you know, dedication to seeing a functioning federal immigration system. But 700, I was concerned that it flew in the face of the supremacy clause. And so that's why I ended up being a no on that one. So yeah, that one's been an interesting kind of nuanced conversation. But the honest truth is, I mean, what we need is exactly what President Trump called for about 6 weeks ago, when he said we need comprehensive immigration reform. And he's not wrong. And there are several industries in our state, that, I mean, throughout the nation, obviously, that that need a functional, you know, either guest worker program, or now that we have a better control over our borders, that have, you know, a functioning immigration program that can bring people as needed, or at least make it more opportune for our own citizens to work in those industries. But yeah, that is a important conversation. It's not an easy conversation. And I think that's what you can see in my votes, where I went yes on one and no on the other. So,
all right. Last minute or two here, Representative. Tell us about your epinephrine bill.
Well, I can't really take credit for it, because that was the work of a PTA mom who reached out to me and said, do you know that right now in statute, if a kid, you know, is dealing with an anaphylactic situation, he can only use an EpiPen? And of course, my first question was, well, is there something besides an EpiPen? And so it was an education for me to find out that, yeah, now there are nasal sprays. The FDA is actually reviewing now a sublingual dose. And so she actually, this PTA mom has also been a school nurse in remote school district. And so she said, you know, I'm wondering if we can work on this language to basically just be agnostic as to how the single dose is delivered for the kid, right? So this means that if a kid is self-administering an epinephrine dose, or if a school nurse or school staff are helping them with appropriate parental permission, then the law covers them to say it's okay to administer a single dose of epinephrine regardless of how it's delivered. And I think one of the most interesting kind of fun things about the conversation with this particular bill is I had many school nurses reach out to me and say, you know, thank you for moving this legislation forward, because a lot of kids do not like needles. And so it ends up being kind of a hesitation moment for them, even though they're, you know, having an allergic reaction and they could be in real trouble. And so it's so much easier for some of them to just do the nasal spray. And then there's also a program that puts four doses of that, and Neffy is the product. So Neffy for schools puts four doses of that product in every school. And so it really checks a lot of boxes to help school districts and students. And so it was just interesting one for me, a little educational, and it's been moving through the process quite well.
Okay. Sounds like a common sense upgrade to the law. So, Representative Wheeler, we appreciate your time. Thank you for joining us today, and wish you luck however long the rest of the session goes. We hope it goes well.
Thanks, Dale and Julie.